Good morning. The National Weather Service is defending its forecasting after a flash flood in Texas killed more than 80 people over the weekend. Experts say pinpointing which spots will get the most rainfall is a big challenge. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu meets with President Trump tonight as mediators work with both Israel and Hamas. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. But Netanyahu's far-right coalition doesn't want the war to end yet, so what terms could actually bring about a ceasefire? Also, the Department of Justice told tech companies it won't enforce the TikTok ban. What is a president's responsibility to enforce all laws? It is Monday, July 7th. On this day in 1928, a bakery in Chillicothe, Missouri, was the first to sell pre-sliced bread, the greatest thing since, I guess, ever. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. The number of dead in central Texas is still rising. At least 82 people were killed in catastrophic flash flooding on July 4th before dawn. Many victims are children who were at sleepaway camp in Kerr County. NPR's Greg Allen reports some girls and other people swept up by the Guadalupe River are still missing.
People here are just in shock still. I spent some time in the town of Hunt, a small town right along, not too far from Camp Mystic, the girls' camp where, you know, so many of the deaths occurred and where the search is still centered. Hunt was just devastated, though. Many people who live in homes along the river and in RV parks just saw their homes destroyed. Trailers were washed away. Homes and businesses are all flooded in many of the areas.
Search and recovery efforts continue. More rain is in the forecast today, and flood watches are in effect in central Texas. Meanwhile, there are questions about whether officials communicated sufficient weather warnings to those in danger. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is set to visit the White House today. This comes as President Trump is again trying to broker a ceasefire in Gaza, as NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
In a social media post, Trump said he is aiming for a 60-day Gaza ceasefire that would see the release of more Israeli hostages and could lead to an enduring end to a war that has raged since the Hamas attack on Israel October 7, 2023. And then there's the matter of Iran and its nuclear program, which Trump says was knocked out by U.S. airstrikes last month. Trump previewed the Netanyahu visit during a flight on Air Force One.
Well, it's going to be a very quick celebration. We had a great hit. It was a obliteration. Okay, now it turns out it was an obliteration.
Trump says he is open to direct talks with Iran, something Israel has opposed in the past. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
The White House says this Wednesday's tariff deadline could be extended to August 1st for some countries. The president says letters informing trading partners of new tariff rates will start going out today. NPR's Don Gagne reports now.
Tariffs have been Trump's trade weapon of choice. A few months ago, he famously imposed steep and wide-ranging tariffs on imports from more than 100 nations, including close allies like Japan and the European Union. But since that day in April, the president has taken an on-again, off-again approach with some individual nations. That's made the policy difficult to track for negotiators, but also for consumers in the U.S. who will eventually bear the cost. Still, a deadline for countries to reach an agreement with the Trump White House looms. Don Gagne, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Leaders of some of the world's emerging economies are convening in Brazil for the annual BRICS conference. The bloc of 11 member countries condemned the war in Gaza and U.S. strikes on nuclear sites in Iran. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports from Rio de Janeiro.
Brazil's President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, host of this year's BRICS summit, opened with criticism of NATO's move to hike military spending. It's always easier to invest in war than in peace, Lula told a packed hall of leaders from emerging economies. The group, which has attempted to be a geopolitical counterweight to G7 economies, recently expanded to include many Middle Eastern nations as well as Indonesia and Ethiopia. Consensus among the differing countries has been tough, but it did release a declaration Sunday, which not only took aim at the U.S.'s ongoing tariff hikes, which it says threatens global trade, but also expressed, quote, grave concern for the humanitarian situation in Gaza. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
Elon Musk says he's formed a new political party called the America Party. Musk posted this on X over the weekend. He says it's in response to President Trump's new sweeping tax cut and spending law, which Musk criticized as bankrupting the country. Tropical depression Chantal is moving across southern and eastern Virginia. Heavy rain is expected there and in parts of Delaware and southern New Jersey and Pennsylvania. The National Weather Service says there is a threat of flash flooding. Several counties in North Carolina are now dealing with major flooding from Chantal and water rescues. I'm Kristen Wright, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
November 7th, 1989. Jim Houtman rolled out of bed with a feeling of what? Expectancy? Dread? Because this was the biggest day of the year for Folks in his line of work. He was a wildlife artist. And today, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service would announce this year's winner, the duck stamp. Houtman had mailed in an entry this year, an acrylic painting of two black-bellied ducks. He'd already won the Nevada and Minnesota state competitions, but this was big time. He was up against 600 of the best wildlife artists in the nation. Houtman had grown up in St. Louis Park with a paintbrush in his hand. His mom was an artist, but he didn't think he was any good until kindergarten, when he noticed that the other kids turned out normal kindergarten drawings and Houtman something much more professional. As an adult, he went from painting houses to painting and selling duck art, a commitment that would finally pay off today when Jim Houtman learned that he'd won the 1989 Federal Duck Stamp Competition at the age of 25.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. President Trump says there could be a ceasefire deal in Gaza this week, with some hostages in Gaza going free.
I think there's a good chance we have a deal with Hamas during the week. During the coming week, pertaining to quite a few of the hostages.
That's what Trump will be discussing this evening with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the White House. It will be their first meeting since the U.S. joined Israel in attacking Iran's nuclear sites 2 weeks ago.
NPR's Daniel Estrin has been following all this from Tel Aviv. Daniel, good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
So how close is a ceasefire deal in Gaza based on your reporting?
We are not expecting a ceasefire deal to be announced today. It could take a few more days or longer. Israel and Hamas just began talks in Doha, Qatar yesterday, and mediators in the region tell us that the Israeli and Hamas delegations are on different floors of the same hotel in Doha, and mediators are shuttling between them. But remember, Netanyahu just landed today in Washington. A person who was briefed on the matter, who was not authorized to speak publicly, told me that Netanyahu is expected to meet Trump's Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio to talk over the details of what a Gaza deal would look like before Netanyahu meets Trump for dinner.
Can you just give us a sense of what a ceasefire deal might look like? I mean, is it temporary? Would it actually lead to the end of the war in Gaza?
We saw a recent draft of the deal that is being negotiated. It starts with a 60-day ceasefire. During that time, Hamas would release 10 out of the 20 living hostages it still holds. Israel would release Palestinian prisoners. And starting on day one of the ceasefire, the two sides would begin discussing the terms of a final end of the war. Now, Netanyahu's latest mantra is that there will be no more Hamas in Gaza. So we are expecting discussions between the U.S. and Israel this week in Washington about what that would look like. Does that mean expelling the few remaining senior Hamas militants from Gaza? What would it look like for Hamas to lay down its arms? Who would replace Hamas in governing Gaza? Those are the issues that need to be discussed.
So it was just 2 weeks ago that the U.S. joined Israel's attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities. Now Trump is looking for a ceasefire deal in Gaza. Is this all connected, Daniel? Is there a bigger strategy at play here?
I think it is all connected, Michelle. We spoke to a person briefed on the matter who was not authorized to speak about it publicly, who said that Netanyahu and Trump will be discussing what kind of diplomatic deal Israel would want to see with Iran, what would want the U.S. to forge with Iran over the future of its nuclear program. You know, Trump did attack Iran's nuclear sites with bombs that Israel does not possess. That is something Netanyahu had long wanted, and now Netanyahu knows what Trump wants. Trump wants an end to the Gaza war. Trump promised his voters when he was running for election that he would end wars. He wants to be the president to end the Gaza war so that he can broker diplomatic ties between Israel and other Arab or Muslim countries. But that puts Netanyahu in a tough spot. His far-right political partners in government do not want the war to end. But for Netanyahu, ending the war and freeing the hostages from Gaza is a kind of image of victory that could help Netanyahu. He is eyeing a potential new election here in Israel.
That is NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Daniel, thank you.
You're welcome.
To get into more about what's at stake with these negotiations for a ceasefire, we're joined by Hussein Ibish. He's a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, D.C. Hussein, good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Led.
So there have been so many failed negotiations in the past. At this point, has something changed? Do both Netanyahu's government and the Hamas leadership actually want a deal?
I think it's hard to say about Israel. Hamas leaders do want a deal as long as it leads to an end to the war and the removal of Israeli troops from all or almost all of Gaza. And that's really their overriding goal. Whether the Israelis really want to end the war or not is the big unanswered question, because Netanyahu, from the beginning, has set an impossible goal, which is the elimination of Hamas. And Hamas is not a list of people who can be killed and items that can be destroyed. It's a political brand. So it really, you know, would require Israel to make some fundamental decisions about where it's going in its relationship, not just with Gaza, but with all of the Palestinians into the coming decades.
What do you expect to happen this week?
Well, I think it's likely that we'll get progress towards a ceasefire. We may even get a ceasefire. But the question is, will it be more interesting and more enduring than the last one? The last one, which was at the beginning part of this year, lasted for 60 days, just about, that it was supposed to last for, and this is sort of a redux of that. But then Netanyahu sort of broke it unilaterally with an extremely violent attack that killed about 80 Palestinians and a very large number of them children, and then the war was back on. And so one of the big questions is, you know, whether Israel is going to commit to something that will endure beyond that period of time. And that's, I think, one of Hamas's big holdouts.
Has the appointment of Izzeddin al-Haddad as a new Hamas leader in Gaza changed anything?
I don't think al-Haddad changes anything. I think he's clearly the leader because there are so few left. And he does apparently play a role, a significant role, in deciding Hamas's response to these proposals, because the gunmen on the ground in Gaza still have the predominant power in the organization, not the political figures in exile in Turkey and in Qatar. But, you know, in the end, he's not an experienced leader, and he's not a visionary, so he just represents more of the same.
You say the elimination of Hamas is not a realistic goal. I mean, what is a realistic goal so that Israelis have security, Palestinians have security, and this war can end?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a clear formula to it, which is for Israel to withdraw, for Hamas to recede from government and to allow the creation of an alternative Palestinian civic administration. But the Israelis have been resisting this for well over a year now, because in the end, Palestinian politics are binary, right? And anything that strengthens Hamas is likely to weaken the PLO and the PA in Ramallah, vice versa. So if there is an alternative to Hamas created, it will derive its strength from the PLO and the PA in Ramallah, and that Israel fears because they could eventually create a Palestinian state. And that's Israel's biggest concern. The overriding goal in the end is, I think, annexation of the West Bank.
Hossein Ibish is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute. Thank you for your time.
You're so welcome, Leila. Thank you.
The Justice Department says it is aggressively prioritizing efforts to strip citizenship from naturalized U.S. citizens who commit certain crimes. It's the latest effort by the Trump administration to reshape the nation's immigration system. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz has the story.
When an immigrant becomes a naturalized citizen in the United States, they vow to support and defend the Constitution, as can be heard in this naturalization ceremony from 2019.
That I will support and defend,
that I will support and defend,
the Constitution and laws,
the Constitution and laws
of the United States.
Laura Bingham, a law professor at Temple University, says these individuals become naturalized citizens, gaining the perceived protection and finality of American citizenship.
And it's not supposed to be something that you can continuously open up for some people and you can't for others.
But certain naturalized citizens could be at risk under a new memo from the Justice Department. U.S. attorneys are being told to prioritize denaturalization, or revoking citizenship, in cases involving naturalized citizens who commit certain crimes. Those crimes could include anything from national security incidents to cases of fraud. And the DOJ is also giving U.S. attorneys wider discretion on when to pursue denaturalization.
So to see that this administration is plotting out how they're going to expand its use in ways that we have not seen before is very shocking and very concerning.
That was Samira Hafiz with the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, a national advocacy organization. In our nation's history, revoking someone's citizenship was traditionally used in cases involving war criminals, Nazis, or communists. The Justice Department said in an email to NPR that denaturalization will only be pursued in cases where, quote, a person illegally procured or misrepresented facts in the naturalization process. And the agency says it's committed to maintaining the integrity of the naturalization program. Cassandra Robertson, a law professor at Case Western Reserve University, says the peak of denaturalization was during the McCarthy era, when it was used as a tool to target political enemies. It came up again during the Obama administration. Now, Robertson is concerned that the DOJ memo also says that the government will pursue denaturalization cases through civil litigation.
Where the individual is not entitled to an attorney, where there's no statute of limitations, and the person might not even have known that a proceeding was filed against them.
For example, Elliot Duke is an American military veteran originally from the UK who lost their citizenship in recent weeks. They were convicted for receiving and possessing child sexual abuse material. We spoke with Duke. They said they were served denaturalization papers while in prison back in February. The proceedings over their citizenship happened in another state without them present and without a lawyer. Here's Laura Bingham again.
I see really grave risks with starting to open up these kinds of conversations about who belongs.
Bingham said that regardless of the crimes Duke committed, the situation sets a dangerous precedent. Duke, who has years to go in their prison term, is now effectively stateless. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
I'm Jennifer Barr, a producer here at KAXC. One of the things I do is write public service announcements for our hosts to read on air. We love sharing information about all the things that happen throughout our region, things that make northern Minnesota a great place to live. From Bagley to Virginia, from Brainerd to Big Fork, we want to hear from you. Let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. Again, that's psa@kaxc.org. Send us info at least 2 weeks in advance of your event. Thanks for helping us build community in northern Minnesota.
NPR comes from the station. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldel. Texas officials are criticizing federal weather forecasters after a deadly storm swept through the state over the holiday weekend. At least 82 people are dead after the historic flooding that followed. As NPR's Joe Hernandez reports, the National Weather Service says it warned the public in the days and hours before the flood.
Around the middle of last week, Texas officials were marshaling their resources to prepare for the storm. The National Weather Service was warning of pockets of heavy rain and the potential for flooding. But when the storm arrived Friday, its ferocity caught many people by surprise. The Guadalupe River rose 26 feet in just 45 minutes.
The original forecast that we received on Wednesday from the National Weather Service predicted 3 to 6 inches of rain in the Concho Valley and 4 to 8 inches of rain in the hill country.
Texas Division of Emergency Management Chief Nim Kidd said at a press conference Friday that what happened was much worse.
As many of you know, and many of you in broadcast journalism and meteorology, you can go back and look at your own forecast, and the amount of rain that fell in this specific location was never in any of those forecasts.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott said on Sunday that the weather warnings didn't communicate just how serious the threat was, especially to an area that's used to flooding.
There's the potential for flash flooding, but there's no expectation of a water wall of almost 30 feet high.
But in a statement, the National Weather Service defended its forecasting. It noted the agency held briefings for emergency officials on Thursday and issued flood watches, flood warnings, and even a flash flood emergency, which is only used in rare cases. Michael Morgan, a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, says the storm highlighted the difficulty of forecasting.
I think the Weather Service forecasts were on point, specifically targeting in locations that are going to receive the maximum rainfall is an incredibly challenging forecast problem.
Some critics also raised questions about whether job cuts to the National Weather Service by the Trump administration had made the agency's job more challenging. And Morgan noted that the administration was also planning to cut funding for two federal offices that work on improving weather forecasting.
And I think it's investments in that are really going to help mitigate future tragedies like what unfolded in Texas.
The National Weather Service announced last month that it was working to hire more than 100 employees after losing over 500 workers earlier this year. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
Somebody who understands the factors that turn torrents of rain into a catastrophic flood is Greg Waller. He is a hydrologist at the West Gulf River Forecast Center of the National Weather Service, which means he studies the science of what happens to water when it hits the ground, and he's with us now. Greg Waller, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Michelle.
So why is part of Texas known as Flash Flood Alley?
It's one of those cases where every time we bring in a new forecaster, we tell them, this area you need to watch. It is close to a moisture source, plenty of moisture from the Gulf. It has a natural rise, upslope in the Balcones Escarpment, which can provide a source of lift. The soils are very rocky, which means any rain that falls, very efficient at generating runoff. And then it's sloped with the hills by the name Hill Country. So that means any runoff occurs fast. So you have fast moving, very good runoff into the small creeks and rivers that can go from a couple of inches to a trickle up to 20 plus feet in a matter of hours, depending on the rain events.
Has this been getting worse over time?
I'm not going to say it's going to get it worse over time for the weather and the hydrology, but what I will say is, you know, it's a very popular area. So you have to add the social vulnerability of more people moving in, creating a larger vulnerable footprint. Mm-hmm. That is some of the most beautiful and scenic areas of the state of Texas, and it's popular for vacationers. So you mix in a holiday, you mix in a lot of visitors, you mix in a extreme rain event into a very sensitive area, and unfortunately, we see the results.
So we understand that in the area we're talking about, where the worst of the flooding took place, within 45 minutes, 10 to 12 inches of rain fell, and the floodwater rose by 26 feet. Can you explain how that's possible?
It's volumes of water. Think of the column of atmosphere and all the rain that comes down all at once. We had ties into a couple of tropical systems. There was a Pacific system with leftover high-level moisture, Barry from the low-level system, so we had plenty of moisture in place. We had lift, and once the thunderstorms developed, they tapped into all that available moisture and very slow-moving. That's the key. These thunderstorms were very slow moving and produced a lot of rain. Rainfall rates help generate runoff as much as rainfall amounts.
So let me emphasize that you are not a spokesperson for the National Weather Service, but I just wanted to ask, is the forecasting able to predict such a thing, this kind of event?
I am a forecaster for the National Weather Service, mm-hmm. and I will say in my career, the science is getting better. It is not perfect. We are doing our best to try to push the limits with ensemble modeling, better high-resolution modeling, but this is Mother Nature. And the difference in 15 to 20 miles in a placement of a thunderstorm, which is a good weather forecast, that could be a bad river forecast, hydrology forecast, because that could be a completely different river basin. Mm. Our science and skill is getting better, and we need to continue to strive to make it even more so.
So even with that, I think what you're telling me is that these events still are unpredictable to a certain degree?
I'm not going to say unpredictable to the point of we were familiar that there was the possibility of a heavy rain event. Mm. It's the precision that we need to work on. We knew that there would be thunderstorms. We knew there'd be locally heavy rain. It's the precision of getting that exact rainfall amount in the exact location to assist. The weather forecast offices, you know, capture that with their flash flood warnings and flood watches. But there's always room for improvement in this science.
And so then the question becomes, are our systems for response able to keep up?
That's not in my field, the response. Mm-hmm. We try to provide the best forecast possible, the best information possible, so that those decision makers can make the best decision. We will be involved in the process, but the response, education, awareness, and you've got to be able to respect what Mother Nature can bring.
That's Greg Waller. He's with the West Gulf River Forecast Center of the National Weather Service. Mr. Waller, thanks so much for sharing this expertise with us.
Thank you very much.
This is NPR News.
When Vice President Kamala Harris took over the Democratic ticket last summer, top Biden campaign staff remained in place.
Now, a lot of Harris aides think that was actually a fundamental flaw because the people who were driving the process were not her people.
A new book reveals the tensions between Harris and President Biden and how it led to the Democrats' failure in 2024. On the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered starts at 4 o'clock this afternoon with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 529. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in just a few moments, our daily dose of phenology with John Latimer. He will look back at this date in his Nature Notes, July 7th. The Association of Cass County Lakes has a presentation with loon biologist Dr. Walter Piper this Saturday, July 12th, 1 p.m. at Salem Lutheran Church in Longville. And the Friends of the Grand Rapids Area Library have their annual summer book sale Friday, July 11th from 10 to 6, Saturday, July 12th from 9 to 5 at Community Presbyterian Church. And the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources offers the Lawns to Legumes program, which aims to increase habitat for at-risk pollinators in residential settings. The deadline to apply for the 2026 season is November 30th. Find more info and apply at bluethumb.org. Northland Arboretum in Brainerd has a soft grand opening and fundraiser for their new bike park on Saturday, July 12th, noon to 5. Food and beverage will be available for purchase, plus you can play yard games and try the trails. Protective gear is required if you are riding a bike. Lake Bemidji State Park has reopened after the damaging storm that happened in that area on June 21st. The campground beach and Rocky Point Trail are all currently open. Other trails remain closed until further notice. And at KAXC Local Matters, we bring you updates on news and events relative to our rural communities. We do this because we live here too. Federal funding helps make this kind of local coverage possible, and that is at risk right now. Visit protectmypublicmedia.org to share what KAXC brings to our community. Thanks so much for listening. It's time for our daily dose of phenology. Here is John Latimer.
On today's date, July the 7th, in the year 2003, the Juneberries are ripe. Juneberries are a rather interesting plant because they flower simultaneously, synchronously. They are all in flower at once. And this provides the bees with a sort of absolutely a smorgasbord of flowers to get nectar from and to get pollen from. And it provides the Juneberries with a completely solitary blossom in the fact that there are no other plants blooming at the same time, and the bees can focus on only the Juneberry. Though they flower simultaneously, synchronously, they fruit asynchronously. So you're going to have one ripe Juneberry here and another ripe Juneberry over there. Meanwhile, all the other Juneberries on the plant are going to be somewhere between being green and being ripe. And that makes it difficult for you and I to harvest Juneberries because the robins are checking the Juneberries every couple of minutes and making sure that any ripe Juneberry ends up in their mouth. And we check the Juneberries every couple of days, hoping that suddenly they'll all be ripe and we can pick enough for a pie. It never quite works out that way.
PR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. And from Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. yptc.com/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The Trump administration has released copies of letters it sent to tech companies telling them they wouldn't be prosecuted or punished for violating a congressional ban on TikTok. Now, this is a law that passed under the Biden administration and was then upheld by the Supreme Court earlier this year. So can the administration just not enforce it? To discuss this, we're joined by Zachary Price. He's a constitutional law professor at the University of California College of Law, San Francisco. Good morning, and thanks for being on the program.
Thanks very much. Delighted to be here.
So constitutionally, can the president's administration just not enforce a law?
I don't think so. So executive officials have some discretion over how laws are enforced, which cases to pursue, what sorts of violations to prioritize, but they don't have authority over whether laws have effect at all. There have been controversies over where to draw that line, but I think what the administration is doing falls on the wrong side of it.
So how is this different than things we've seen in the past? For example, President Obama exercised discretion with DACA protections for the young immigrants known as Dreamers and with the Affordable Care Act. I mean, how is this different?
Yeah, so I thought those actions by the Obama administration were unlawful as well for the same reasons. President Obama delayed the effect of certain provisions of the Affordable Care Act, which was analogous, and in the DACA program granted what's called deferred action, gave a sort of promise to certain immigrants that they wouldn't be deported for a certain period. And I think those were also efforts to effectively change the law rather than just decide how to enforce it. But the DACA benefits did purport to be revocable. The administration claimed it was just sort of exercising discretion and not prioritizing people for the time being, not legalizing unlawful conduct. And with the Affordable Care Act delays, they said they had the power to grant transition relief, delay the effect of certain provisions in a complex statute. Here you have the president coming in and just completely denying force to an entire statute that Congress enacted based solely on disagreement with the policy that it reflects.
Now, in the letters, the Justice Department wrote, quote, from the Attorney General, that the president's stated goal of protecting national security while making available a communications platform used by millions of Americans. What do you make of that argument?
I don't think it's sound. They are claiming a national security foreign affairs power to do this. And it's true that those are areas of special presidential responsibility. But the Constitution obligates the president to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. And Congress has authority in this area as well. It has the power to regulate commerce between the states and with foreign nations. And pursuant to that power, enacted the TikTok ban. So it's a valid law within Congress's power, and that implicates that duty of the president to ensure that the law is faithfully executed. And it's antithetical to that to claim a power to deny the law effect altogether.
That's Zachary Price, law professor at the University of California College of Law, San Francisco. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
California is considering added protections for doctors who facilitate abortions using telehealth. If it becomes law, it could affect patients across the country. NPR's Katia Riddle has this report.
It's been 3 years since the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. Since then, the number of abortions in this country has actually increased. That's in part because women can receive abortion medication through the mail, even in states where the procedure is restricted. That's due to providers like this one.
I feel grateful that there is this opportunity to provide this care.
R is a doctor based in California. He asked to only be identified by his middle initial out of concern for his safety. He writes prescriptions for the medications mifepristone and misoprostol for patients in states with strict abortion bans.
But it does make it more difficult to do so when my name needs to be on the prescription label.
At least one doctor is currently facing criminal charges for mailing these medications in the U.S. The new bill would allow doctors like R to write a prescription that does not display the name of the doctor or their patient. The medication would still be mailed to someone in a package, but the actual labeling wouldn't reveal either name. Natalie Birnbaum is with Rights. That's a group that advocates for abortions to be available through telehealth. She helped craft the bill in California.
It's our priority to make sure that there are providers that are able and willing and have the least amount of risk to do this work and to keep going.
California is not the first place to put in place a law that offers labeling protections. Birnbaum says it is the first time a state has allowed for a patient's name to be removed from the label as well.
For that patient to say, oh, okay, I don't have to be as worried that if I throw it in the garbage, that an abusive partner or somebody with a very different value system than I do will find this label and then in some way try and penalize me for my choices.
Stephen Aiden is general counsel for the group Americans United for Life. His organization and other anti-abortion advocacy groups argue that legislation like this is not constitutional.
The problem with actions like California is they don't respect what the Supreme Court said in Dobbs.
He says that the Dobbs decision was supposed to empower states, not allow for one state's laws to override another's.
You have a regime of pro-abortion states and a regime where the pro-life laws of some states are just paper tigers. They're meaningless.
It's an issue that could end up before the Supreme Court. A rare point of agreement for people on all sides of this debate is that the U.S. legal system needs to offer clarity on the question of how far a state's authority extends when it comes to telehealth. Until then, providers in California, like R, say they plan to take advantage of their state's new law.
If our society eventually decides that we can't do this, okay, well, maybe we can't do this. In the meantime, large sections of societies have agreed to allow us to do this, which is why we can do this legally, but we should not be personal risk.
R provides prescriptions for abortion medication, even for patients who aren't currently pregnant. With so much uncertainty, he says, it's better to be prepared. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from AG1, introducing AG1 Next Gen, a daily drink with vitamins, minerals, and probiotics to support overall health. Learn more at drinkag1.com/science. And from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public.
This is NPR News.
It's 5:42. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:30, Minnesota Native News, and Laura Erickson will be speaking for the Birds. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library continue their Brown Bag Lunch author series a week from today, Monday, July 14th at noon, with Minnesota author Andrea Gillitz. She will discuss her book Radical Endurance, Growing Old in an Age of Longevity. The McCrossey Art Center presents its annual Downtown Art Fair Saturday, July 12th from 9 to 4 on the grounds of Old Central School in Grand Rapids, with over 40 regional artists, food vendors, hands-on activities, and live music. The KAXC Newsroom has created a map of northern Minnesota's farmers markets throughout the region, from places like Park Rapids to Palo, Tell Moon to Reamer, Black Duck to Crosby. Most markets run through September or October. Find the map at kaxc.org. It is Big Truck Day at the Virginia Public Library this Thursday from 10:30 to noon. See big machines and the vehicles that help keep our community safe. Fifth Avenue will be blocked off in front of the library for this event. And the Bemidji Senior Center invites you to their Oodles of Noodles and Yankee Doodles fundraiser. That is tonight, 6 o'clock. Enjoy a spaghetti dinner, followed by a patriotic concert by the First City Singers. There is more ahead from Morning Edition here on KAXC.
It's the people of northern Minnesota that power KAXC.
I'm a member because I feel a sense of belonging being part of KAXC, because I know that they are representing me and the communities and people in our area and the work that we're doing in such a truthful and honest way. I love being able to share it nationally and tell people I've met across the nation, like, you can understand more about what it's like to live in northern Minnesota by listening online. There's so much that is of value to people anywhere. It's just an honor to contribute and be part of it.
Help us out. Tell us why you are a member. Text us at 218-326-1234 and keep KAXE powered. We're independent, we're local, we're not run by corporations, the government, or a national network. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Odoo, maker of business management software with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. From Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at raymondjames.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Mexico is the CONCACAF Gold Cup men's champion. It defeated the U.S. 2-1 in Sunday's final. That was the last competitive game for the U.S. before the U.S., along with Mexico and Canada, co-host next year's FIFA World Cup. And it was an important preview of the World Cup for both the team and for the hosts. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan is with us now to tell us more about it. Kind of a heartbreaker, Becky, kind of.
Maybe. Kind of. A little bit, yeah. I mean, you know what, Michelle? Sometimes in sports, one team is just better than the other. I think that's what happened last night with Mexico and the U.S. The U.S. did have, like, a little bit of an uphill battle going into the game. In some ways, they had played in this tournament with their, like, B squad. A bunch of the usual starters were out with injury or had other conflicts. And, in fact, the team's biggest star, Christian Pulisic, had simply opted to sit out, which caused a little drama before the tournament began. Meanwhile, you had Mexico playing more or less at full strength with a team that basically is the one we'll see next year at the World Cup. Besides that, or despite that, the U.S. took an early lead, but Mexico pretty much just dominated this game, dominated the time of possession, had many more chances, realistic shots on goal. But still pretty fun to watch two World Cup caliber teams duking it out in a competitive match just a year to go.
Yeah, so say more about that. You did find it a satisfying watch, right? So what did we learn about the U.S. team from this tournament?
In whole. Yeah, the tournament in a whole, a mixed bag for the U.S. Definitely a huge improvement over where they were a month ago when they had just lost these four international friendly games in a row, the worst losing streak they've had in years. And so it was nice to see them bounce back in the Gold Cup, which is a tournament for teams for North and Central America, the national teams. But that competition is mostly pretty easy. Mexico is by far the best team they played in the tournament. They lost. And in fact, you know, they definitely looked worse. And the U.S. is going to have to be able to win games like that to advance at the World Cup. I will say a bright spot was that the absence of some of those star players, you know, allowed other guys to step up and shine. So it was a very memorable tournament for players like Diego Luna, who's 21-year-old with bleach blonde hair, lots of tattoos, plays for Real Salt Lake. Also Malik Tillman, who's a 23-year-old German-American dual national. I think many fans of the U.S. men's national team, despite the loss, you know, feel excited about guys like that.
So this tournament was seen as a dress rehearsal for the, not just for the team, right, but also for the U.S. as a host of the World Cup next year.
Definitely.
What do you think? How did they do?
I mean, yeah, so there was this tournament, then there was also the Club World Cup, which is another FIFA event that was held around the U.S. this summer and, in fact, is still ongoing. You know, many of the games have been held in sort of like soccer stadiums or smaller stadiums that are not World Cup venues. But at least in the Gold Cup, five of the stadiums used are also set to be World Cup venues next year. So obviously lots to learn. I think it has gone well, though. Attendance at times has been an issue in these events, not for the Gold Cup final, though, last night, which is announced ahead of time that it had sold out more than 70,000 tickets. I think that's in line with what we'll see next summer.
Well, from the sound of that crowd, it definitely seems like a sellout to me. Okay, briefly, yep. If you can, what about possible immigration issues, both for the athletes and for fans trying to come into the U.S. for the World Cup?
Oh, yeah. For the athletes, you know, Trump's travel ban executive order had a specific carve-out for players in the World Cup, so that's not a concern. For visitors, you know, some might be unwilling to risk any immigration or visa problems, given the administration's tougher stance on the issue. U.S. officials are warning of significant wait times for visas. Sometimes the wait times in some of these places can be very long, months long. And so, you know, with less than a year or way to go, people may find they don't have enough time to get a visa for
that. That is NPR's Becky Sullivan. Becky, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
So much for listening to KAXE KBXE. My name is Heather Johnson, and I'm the membership coordinator here. If you're enjoying our music, news, phonology updates, and conversations, consider supporting the station by becoming a KAXE KBXE member today. Do you have questions about membership? We offer many options for making your contribution. I would love to chat with you. Give me a call at 218-326-1234.
Minus 3 days until we get trade deals, higher tariffs, or both, or neither.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager. With crowds gathering for summer festivals and sporting events, Bitwarden is designed to support secure access to accounts across devices anywhere, from grandstands to general admission. Bitwarden.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. The deadline for countries the world over to agree to trade deals with the U.S. is Wednesday. Or maybe not. Sky-high tariffs announced and delayed in April could come roaring back on Wednesday. Or maybe not. President Trump and his advisors are issuing mixed messages. Marketplace's Nova Sappho sorts it out for us.
90 deals in 90 days was the promise almost 90 days ago when President Trump paused so-called reciprocal tariffs, the initial imposition of which sent stock and bond markets plummeting. Well, the 90 days are up this Wednesday, and the administration has announced two limited deals, one with the UK, the other with Vietnam. So now, as that deadline approaches, there are a number of new developments. For one, officials say more deals could come within days. In the meantime, they appear to be buying themselves more time, delaying the imposition of higher tariffs until August 1st. The president said his administration will send out letters to an unspecified number of countries as soon as noon Eastern today, apparently regarding either new tariff rates or new deals. The president also threatened new 10% tariffs on nations aligned with the BRICS group of developing countries, which includes Brazil, Russia, and China. That group over the weekend issued a statement criticizing tariffs without specifically naming the U.S. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York is going to give us an update on how we consumers feel about inflation, specifically what we think is going to happen to prices in the future. Inflation expectations have been rising over the past 6 months. A survey in June from the University of Michigan found that even though actual inflation right now is around 2.4%, we consumers think it'll get up to 5% a year from now. This is something economists track because the thing about inflation is that it can be as much about psychology as it is about prices. What we think inflation's going to do can affect what inflation actually ends up doing. Marketplace's Matt Levin has that.
So if you think the price of a car or washing machine is going to be a lot higher a year from now, the economically rational thing to do would be to buy said car or washing machine right now. And while you're at it, maybe think about asking for a raise. Brian Colton is an economist with Fitch Ratings.
Inflation expectations matter because they affect people's behavior. So they will affect the willingness of workers to carry on working with a given level of wages.
Higher consumer demand plus higher wages could lead businesses to charge higher prices. A self-fulfilling inflationary nightmare for the Fed. Oddly, this year, inflation expectations have been rising while actual inflation readings have been pretty stable. Economist Yuri Gorodnichenko at UC Berkeley says tariffs and even short-lived jumps in oil prices are triggering post-COVID inflation memories.
Everybody was scarred by, you know, recent inflation surge. They think, you know, high inflation can happen. It's a realistic scenario.
Even if we haven't seen tariffs really impact prices all that much, at least not yet, I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are all down in the 1 to 5/10% range, with the Dow futures down 55 points. The 10-year Treasury yield is at 4.36%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com. And by Viking, exploring the world in comfort. With a fleet of small ships, Viking offers travel experiences for the thinking person. Discover more at viking.com.
What's the line between a brand following a trend and outright copying a design? That is the question behind a Lululemon lawsuit against Costco. The athleisure brand says the discount warehouse ripped off designs of its popular sweatshirt and pants. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab takes a look at how successful these kinds of design lawsuits generally are.
Dupe culture has taken over social media.
Dupe fragrances that you can wear every day.
This tank is a Skims dupe, but better.
This is your sign to save yourself some money and get some dupes.
Call it a dupe, a copycat, or a knockoff. Though the trending term has changed over the years, the idea has been around for a long time, as long as people have been making stuff. Sarah Fackrell is a law professor at Illinois Tech.
This is nothing new. This is one reason why we even have design patents in the first place.
Design patents protect, well, the design of a product, its shape, pattern, and overall appearance. But getting a court to side with a patent owner to say, yes, Lululemon, Costco has copied your design, that is a difficult bar to pass.
So you got to prove that someone's going to look at that jacket and think that it was made or sponsored or approved by Lululemon, just on how it looks.
That's pretty subjective. Plus, once you open this can of worms, the lawsuit possibilities become endless. Is the Ford Bronco a dupe for a Jeep? Is Pepsi a dupe for Coke? What is the difference between inspiration and outright copying? Christopher Durham is president of the Velocity Institute, which does private label consulting.
If you look across all of retail, 95% of all things are duplicates. 5% are innovation.
Durham says this is how trends work, and that competition is good for consumers because it means more selection and lower prices. Private labels have become so popular that consumers, once embarrassed by being seen with off-brand cereal, now seek dupes out. Think Costco's Kirkland, Sephora's Sephora Collection, and Target's Good & Gather.
Trader Joe's has been making JoJo's for 50 years. That recipe is just different enough that they don't get sued. And honestly, a lot of people think the JoJo's are better than the Oreos.
With the rising popularity of private labels and copycat culture, Jan Benedict Steenkamp, a marketing professor at UNC Chapel Hill, thinks we'll see more brands take legal action.
Every percentage point market share that you lose to a private label, it really bites into your bottom line.
These lawsuits can be beneficial for plaintiffs.
Not because they necessarily will win them all.
But because enough legal action can scare other copycatters away, making everyone more likely to copycat something else. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
And in New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Good morning. You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for more from Morning Edition and the Monday Morning Show. We'll have Minnesota Native News and For the Birds coming up after 6:30. Just after 7 o'clock, we'll have a special edition of the Up North Report. Local news from our region. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for businesses like smart biz to manage voice and Wi-Fi services, security cameras, and more. Online at paulbunyan.net, Paul Bunyan Communications, it's right here. 9 o'clock this morning, Heather Johnson, your host for